Hi everybody, this is Steve Savitsky and welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today we have Rabbi Aaron Reichel, who is the grandson of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. And he wrote a really beautiful article in the Jewish Action, which is for the fall of 2013. Rabbi Reichel, how are you?
Thank God, good.
That's good, that's very, very nice. Now I understand you also have written a book called The Maverick Rabbi, which was also about Rabbi Goldstein, correct?
Correct.
Okay, very interesting. So as you read this, you really see what a Renaissance person he really was. And of course, we at the Orthodox Union of all places have the deepest respect because he was a former president of the Orthodox Union and as a former president myself. So we were in the same club.
Right, and what's particularly noteworthy, I think, is that he was the president at the time when the OU, Kosher Department, was first inaugurated. And in addition to that, his wife was very instrumental in it happening. There was an unusual couple. His wife was also the national president of the women's branch during the first decade or so of its existence.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Most people don't know that it was actually through the women's branch that the kashrus really got started.
Exactly.
Right. So maybe you could elucidate on that a little bit, because people don't even know that.
Well, as I understand it, my grandmother was very practical, and bringing up people in America in those days, it wasn't so easy to be a Jew. Now people don't realize it. It's much easier to be an observant Jew. In those days, it wasn't. And again, remember now, there was no such thing as any kosher symbol. There was no okay, no OU or anything else. And she said, you know, I tell my children, you can't eat this, you can't eat that. When you go into a store, she said, I'd like to be able to tell them you can eat. You know, there are things that you can eat. So they came up with the idea of trying to set up a kashrus on a national scale to contact various companies to set up some kind of a kashrus authorization. And they did that originally with a Loose Wild Biscuit Company and Sheffield's Milk and a couple of others. Heinz was one of the early ones.
Well, Heinz was the first national company, right?
Well, I was told Loose Wild's Biscuit or something like that. But maybe they weren't as national. Maybe Heinz was more national than that. I don't know how large that Loose Wild's Biscuit Company was, or Sheffield Milk. But I think they came first before Heinz. Although I see the publicity seems to say Heinz was the first national.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I read about that in your article. You talk about your grandmother, Rebecca, and talk about the role that she had as far as being a Rebbetzin, which you know, was quite unusual in those days, right?
Right. It was I was telling most people, I remember I was in a class, Rabbi Lookstein of a blessed memory was saying that he met with Rebbetzins, with future Rebbetzins of rabbis, and said, marry a rabbi and see the world. You know, and a lot of people married a rabbi had no idea what they were getting into, that they would become a Rebbetzin. And a lot of them, they're not really into it. They're not really, they weren't prepared for it, and had no idea what to expect. But in the case of my grandmother, that was her goal. She wanted to be a Rebbetzin, even before there was such a thing as an Americanized rabbi. She wanted to be a Rebbetzin, and already she narrowed it down to two rabbis. And
really?
I won't say on the year the other one, but the other one was also prominent, and she got her way.
Isn't that unbelievable? Now, your grandfather lived from when to when?
He's born in 1890, and he passed away in 1970.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so when he was president of the OU in when was it, 19...
In the 1920s, around 1925, something like that, until 1933, approximately that period of time.
Right. Interesting, very interesting.
And his wife was president from around that time, the beginning, and her term lasted longer. He was about, I believe, 9 years, and she was 13 years.
Wow.
So it's not like she was hanging on to his coattails. She was a very powerful person in her own right and a kind of a leader.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. Now, he was a rabbi in a time when most rabbis in America were probably from Europe, and he was really either the first or one of the first American-born rabbis who received smicha, right?
Correct. He was, He was the first American-born and educated Orthodox rabbi of national prominence. I heard that there was one who didn't become prominent who claims, I understand I spoke to a descendant who claims there was one earlier, but didn't become prominent. But earlier than that, there had been Rabbi Drachman, who was American-born, but he was ordained in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The ordination was very unusual in those days, as long as we're on the subject of setting a precedent. In those days, the Jewish Theological Seminary was borderline Orthodox. It was originally founded by Orthodox people. It was borderline. So Rabbi Goldstein was the valedictorian there, but at the same time, he got smicha from the president of the Agudas HaRabbanim in those days. So it was. So he got something, so he was acceptable in wherever he went.
Uh-huh. Now, but imagine in those days, many of the people were Yiddish-speaking people. Did he speak Yiddish also?
Not too well, from what I understand, not too well. He spoke some. And what was special, what was unique, was that he was, completely Americanized and could relate to the next generation.
So as the melting pot was really, spreading, there he was trying. Really, when you talk about it, also it's interesting because we at EOU, do so much with Kirov, and when you read about him, you realize that he was a Kirov rabbi. He went out and found people who were out there in the pool halls and other places and brought them back.
I'll tell you something. It's a little bit of an aside, but a book is being written about Shlomo Carlebach now, and I happen to have read the manuscript, and they made some claim about Kirov, and as a result of what I told about my grandfather, he mentioned it in the book about Shlomo Carlebach as a precursor doing Kirov. Because at the time of World War I, my grandfather, Rabbi Goldstein, distributed hundreds of tefillin at an army camp around the time of World War I on behalf of the Jewish Welfare Board. Now that sounds like Lubavitch, but he was doing it all the way back then.
And he was an innovative, out-of-the-box thinker. And I think he saw the shul not just as a place for davening, but it was a kind of a multi-purpose institution. So we'll tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, the whole idea of an institutional synagogue was it was to be efficient, three institutions at one, a synagogue, a Y, and a Talmud Torah, the equivalent of all three of them in one. In those days, there was almost no such thing as a day school, a yeshiva day school. A Y was the best that they had in those days. And he combined them. But what was unique, there were other synagogue, there were other Jewish centers, a few different, the claims are being made to who really founded the Jewish center, but what was particularly unique about the institutional synagogue was that the goal was to get the people into the synagogue. It wasn't just to say, okay, you can go to you can go to clubs, you can go to a pool, you can go to the basketball court, or you can go to a Talmud Torah, one or the other. But his goal was to get them into the synagogue, and he said that he was once offered a huge sum of money to change the name into, not to call it the institutional synagogue. People didn't like the centrality of the synagogue. Call it a Jewish center. Call it something else. And he refused to accept that money because he wanted people to know that that was the goal, to get people into the synagogue.
And one of the ways to get them in was to have a nice gym and a place for them to have a pool and everything, right?
Right. They had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. They had a gym. And he had Benny Leonard, a champion boxer, had a brother who was connected to the shul, and he used to train at the institutional synagogue, which was, imagine what kind of a draw that must have been in those days.
Wow. It's interesting when you think about it, because today as I travel and I go to see the JCCs, beautiful, beautiful facilities with spas and gyms and pools and basketball courts, their problem is most of the people are not Jewish. I go to the JCCs and they tell me, well, our enrollment today is, and now we have to be open on Shabbos because, we just can't keep it closed. So here, this is the complete opposite of what your grandfather had. He had a shul, and making it into, was a shul, but he brought in the sports, and now the sports is what attracts the people, and there's nothing else but the sports because there's not too much Jewish in the JCC anymore other
right.
than the name.
Now, by the way, it's also very important. He had clubs. Imagine 67 different clubs at one time. In with enrollments in that shul. Could you imagine? 67 clubs. And he tried to have Jewish content in the clubs. In those days, there was no television, there was no internet. People had time on their hands. So they wanted, to interact. So they would go to clubs. So this was a big thing in those days. But he made sure that there was a... That in different periods it was treated differently. I'm sure it wasn't always exactly the same throughout the period of time. But they would have sometimes every single club was supposed to start with some kind of a Dvar Torah. It was unheard of in those days. These people were in those days. Imagine if there was no day school, what kind of education these people have? Most of the people had hardly any kind of education. And they were going, and the game was to get them away from the pool halls and away from the gambling casinos, and this was considered a big achievement. But in addition to that, imagine getting such people and getting them to have some kind of a Jewish content in all of these clubs, in every one of them. So this was particularly remarkable, and it shows, again, that not just giving up, not to say, okay, you know, each one is completely independent, but he showed he had a strong goal as to what he wanted to achieve with this.
Imagine if the JCCs today could start off every session, the spin session. Okay, first we'll have a Dvar Torah, and then we'll have the spin session. Oh boy, halavai that could happen today. It would be unbelievable. But just, you know, reading about him and who he was and, you know, the kind of person that he was. I mean, that you knew him. I mean, how old was he? How old were you when he passed away?
Well, I was almost 20. And I was very lucky. I was very close to him because we lived a block away from his house. In fact, my father, listen to this, my father had offers from three different shuls simultaneously when he was a young man in his 20s. Three different major shuls simultaneously. And one of them was the Park East, the one became the Park East. But he chose the West Side Institutional Synagogue, where my grandfather was. And one of the reasons was because one was that he admired Rabbi Goldstein so much, and one was that he was going to be his assistant at first, and one was my mother had wanted to be next to her mother, and her mother later in life needed some healthcare assistance. My mother wanted to be near her. So anyway, as a result of that, we lived a block away. And I spent a lot of time there, you know, when I was growing up. And, I was the oldest child from, you know, of my parents. So I got to spend the most time with him. And he didn't focus on the past. He was always focusing on what did I learn in school, you know, anything clever that any of the teachers said or what did I learn. And not focusing about the past.
Hmm. So those are kind of your memories of your grandfather.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about your grandmother? Because she was you know what I like about the article, because I just felt that, like, you mentioned your grandmother, you talked about her also, which, you know, you can't be a successful rabbi without having a really, really good dynamic rebbetzin. And I mean, it sounded like your grandparents were quite a team together.
Exactly. It was. A real team, and it started even when they were going out. Could you imagine some people? What do you do on a date? You know what they would do on a date when they were going out? They would go rehearse sermons and look up material for sermons. And I mean, they were just so united in interest that they would do this. You don't have many rabbitsons. Also, you know, a book was written about rabbitsons. And there was, not that long ago, and has her. She's one of the Robinsons on the cover, by the way, and it pointed out that at that time, I mean, at the turn of the century, 100 years ago, if a woman wanted to advance in Jewish scholarship or anything like that, she'd have nowadays. You have all kinds of opportunities. Won't get into some of them; a little controversial. But in those days, they had very little about women, Orthodox Jews, Jewish women had very little. Very few opportunities, and one was marry a rabbi. That was, and then you'd be involved. Then you'd be involved, and he could be teaching also, and so on.
And what about the? I saw that he wrote a parish on. Was it on the Chumash or?
Yes. Well, he wrote two things of note. One was on the Bible comments for home reading. In those days, it's probably unprecedented. An American rabbi would write comments. And then this would be, they in the back of the Chumash. They have a Chumash with English and then with the comments. And this was published in various editions and used in various shuls. And it bring in comments, you know, some very traditional comments and some more modern things. And again, so that people, as they were in shul or at home, you know, they could read up on that. He also did something between the lines of the Bible on the Tariq Mitzvahs. Now, another book came out pretty recently called Between the Lines of the Bible.
Really?
But it's completely different. This one was something about the Tariq Mitzvahs, you know, with the reasons for the Tariq Mitzvahs.
So what were the greatest, I mean, like when you think back when he was a Rav, you know, in the early, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on. When did he retire? In 19 what?
Retired around 1960, probably around 1960.
Okay. So what was like the greatest challenge that he faced in that time?
Greatest challenge was to get people away from the pool halls and the gambling casinos, and to get them somewhat involved in Yiddishkeit. You know, they were otherwise, it would have been a completely lost generation. Mm-hmm. And he would do whatever he could. They said he had parades outside. He had bands. He had whatever he could in those days that would attract attention and get people, and eventually into his multi-unit organization, and then eventually into the shul. And of course, you know, into yeshivas, he would encourage people, obviously, you know, then later on to get into yeshivas and so on. Also, he was one of the founders. There's a yeshiva day school called the Manhattan Day School.
Of course.
Prominent day school in Manhattan.
Absolutely.
And what happened was, he tried to do it, he tried to get it started in the 1920s, but he just couldn't get enough support for it at that time. But later on, in the 1940s, he was able to get there. Now, three different shuls, by the way, claimed the credit for it, and I maintain that they're all correct, because it had roots in three different shuls, and his was one of them. The first president of the Hande School was vice president of the Institutional Synagogue, but they all had roots, and you know, that was one of his dreams, to eventually start that Hande School, because, you know, then, you know, Rabbi Lukstein started his Ramaz.
Right.
They both started out with under Ramaz Margolis at the Kilat Yeshiva.
Right, exactly, correct. Well, I tell you, it's really fascinating. I hope people are going to enjoy reading the article in the Jewish Action and then maybe going back and looking at the book, The Maverick Rabbi. And we've been talking to Rabbi Aaron Reichel, who's a grandson of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, the pioneering rabbi, the maverick rabbi, the innovative rabbi, the creative rabbi, with a creative rebbetzin. So thank you so much for coming on the program. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure all the listening audience will look forward to reading the article. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.